There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. You know Jason Lee. How you know him depends probably on your interests. Maybe you know him from his legendary pro skateboarding career, or maybe from his career as an actor in films like Mallrats or Almost Famous, or TV shows like My Name is Earl. You might even know him from his voice work in things like The Incredibles, or those IHOP commercials where he talks about pancakes. But lately, he's getting more and more recognized for his work as a photographer. All film, no digital. Almost a dozen years ago, Jason started taking road trips in his native California, in his new home of Texas. Last year, he spent several weeks in Oklahoma creating a new body of work, commissioned for Philbrook, all Oklahoma, all new work. We sat down to talk with him about that and much more. I think we should start with road trips and talk a little bit about what those mean to you and where this all started. So a little over a dozen years ago, you take this kind of seminal road trip that you kind of look at as the start to where we are now. Where did you go and what was kind of the reason for taking that first photo road trip? You'd already been taking photos, but this was like wanting to go out and actually do something with this?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. So I had a loft space in downtown LA. I had gotten into photography in 2002, started buying cameras, and I had a loft space in downtown LA right around that time. And when you could still get spaces in downtown LA for relatively cheap. And I was doing sort of, I think, what you do when you're first kind of starting out. And I was also really, as an actor, I was around lighting and things like that, right? So my entry into photography wasn't just grabbing a camera and sort of just going out and shooting. My introduction also included things like lighting and color temperature and things like that and motion picture cameras and stuff like that. So when I had my loft space, I started buying lighting. So interestingly enough, the very formative years of my photography, you know, included lighting, trying to light scenes the way movie scenes are lit. And so I would do a lot of sort of portraiture of people, and I would experiment with different color temperatures and different light sources and different types of film. And so it was really kind of like in-studio experimentation with a lot of artificial lighting. And that's how I learned about film, pushing and pulling film and filters and all of these things. And I was shooting a lot of Polaroid film. And found out that Polaroid, sadly, they don't make it anymore, but that they made 8x10 Polaroid film. And so I bought an old 8x10 camera on eBay, which I still have, 8x10 Polaroid film. And I started shooting 8x10 Polaroids in my studio. I thought it was the most amazing thing that you could get an 8x10 inch instant print. That Polaroid actually made film that big.
Now, people think of Polaroid, obviously, in that smaller format. It's the, you know, but this stuff's been around for a while. Other artists have used those large format Polaroids.
The large format Polaroids were mainly used, you know, for product photography sort of back in the day, or, you know, maybe some artists were using it in studio. Everybody was using it. The people that were using it, the big Polaroids were using it indoors.
Did it come in a pack of 10 like the regular ones?
A pack of 15, and a box would have been about $160 or something like that for a box of 15 exposures. But, you know, I was shooting all kinds of cameras, 35 medium format, 4x5, and I would use a lot of the pack film, right, where you pull it out and then you wait and you peel it and you get your print. That's basically what the 8x10 stuff is. And I think I just... one day was kind of like, I want to take this big 8x10 Polaroid film outside, because I had never seen I mean, there wasn't really, there was an Instagram at the time, but I didn't know of many people going outside with that film.
Because you were stuck in the studio doing portraiture and you hadn't kind of seen what it could do outside there.
Yeah, I had smaller cameras and I would sort of shoot photos just kind of randomly here and there. But I think at that time I was mainly really interested in learning everything I could about film. And I took a lot of notes and I read a lot of books and I did a lot of testing. It was sort of a lot of testing. So I didn't really know what I was interested in yet in terms of approach or subject or... So I would just get friends, just anybody I could get into the studio to test some new film or, you know, a different type or style of lighting. And I was doing some portraits with the 8x10 Polaroid film in the studio. I had seen Joel Sternfeld's American Prospects book, and I liked that. I had seen some William Christenberry photos, his Alabama photos, and I was kind of drawn to that, and I just... You know, I thought, I want to start hitting the road and I want to take this film out with me because I hadn't really seen any 8x10 Polaroid film out in the wild, so to speak. So I basically packed up about 8 or 10 boxes of the 8x10 Polaroid film at, of course, a pretty high cost. The separate processor that is required to process the big 8x10 Polaroid film. And I just randomly started driving around California.
Well, set the scene for me. So what kind of car are you in?
So I had at the time, I had a bigger SUV. I had my 1930s Century Universal 8x10 camera. I had the separate Polaroid processor. I had journals, pens, notebooks. I had a clothesline that I put in the back of the SUV, a bunch of clothespins. And I basically just started driving.
From L.A.
I think I originally went 5 north to 14 east, which leads you to 395, which is how you start going up to Mammoth.
Okay. So describe the landscape there a little bit.
Small two-lane highway, the occasional kind of like abandoned diner or gas station with an old kind of... dilapidated Winnebago sitting.
Yeah, kind of that Route 66 vibe, but, Americana.
Yeah, but more depressed than sort of, I mean, there's a lot of Route 66 that's a little bit, it doesn't have the shine that it used to have, of course, but more, I don't know, like, I think it was my first kind of, with photography in mind, it was my first exposure to behind this sort of dilapidation and what used to be unbelievably gorgeous mountain ranges. So I think that might have been the first time that I started kind of paying attention to contrast and those contradictions.
And when you're on this trip and you have kind of a limited amount of film, right? Like you can't take a million photos. So at the beginning, are you kind of taking too many and you're like, okay, I need to be a little more selective? How do you start going, here's where I stop and take this, you know? Because it's all based on your gut, right?
It's all gut.
Was your gut in tune with what you were actually wanting to do at that time? Has it taken time to kind of sharpen the pencil a little bit in that way?
Yeah, certainly there's been some time to, yeah. But I kind of knew somehow. The only thing I can come up with is that I'm from California. We road tripped a lot when I was a kid. We went to Northern California a lot to visit family. We went to Shasta Lake a lot. We stayed in cabins. So I had in my mind windy mountain roads and, you know, memories of, you know, like sort of rustic things or just the simple sort of allure and excitement of being on the road. So I already sort of had that in my blood and certainly from skateboarding, touring the States a lot. How much I took it in consciously, I'm not sure. More of it was probably on a subconscious level.
Did you move a lot as a kid?
No, we were in Southern California for most of my childhood.
Like different houses, though. Did you grow up in the same house for the most part?
Pretty much, yeah. We lived in an apartment. We lived for a stint up in Salem, Oregon. And then the house that I basically learned how to skateboard while living in was the house that I was in from 7 years old until I became a pro skater and moved out.
I asked that because it seems like you are kind of a restless person in a good way, wanderlust. You know, does that come from those trips as a kid, do you think?
That was the skateboarding thing. That kept me in motion. I was so hooked on skateboarding, I didn't care where I lived at that time. I skated to school every day. I skated at school. I'd get in trouble for that. I skated home from school, abandoned my homework. I mean, like literally living and breathing skateboarding, much in the same way that I sort of live and breathe photography now. And acting sort of is something that's kind of exists in between the two.
And were you documenting in just any kind of simple way with cameras your skateboarding career when you were a teenager?
No, I didn't. I was just so hooked on skating. I didn't, I wasn't into any other
activity. I mean, luckily a lot of other people were taking pictures. So
yeah, and in the early 90s when we were making skate videos, I was shooting a lot of Super 8 film. And so I was definitely getting my eye sort of, you know, tuned into sort of visual, you know, creating things visually. I shot a ton of Super 8 film over the course of a couple of years. That was incorporated. We used a lot of that footage for the first stereo video, Stereo Skateboards, which came out in 1994, a video called A Visual Sound. And there's a lot of Super 8 footage in that that I shot. So I was... Because of skateboarding, I had creative inclinations, because the beauty of one of the beautiful things about skateboarding is that it opens up for most skaters that creative brain. And that's why you have, especially today, skateboarders who are successful musicians, designers, photographers, painters. Skateboarding is an incredible avenue that leads you to places that you might not otherwise get to if you're growing up in sort of the suburbs, like a lot of skateboarders. And interestingly enough, a lot of skaters come from kind of broken homes or lower middle class. They might not be privy to or exposed to sort of the arts or sort of creative things. And I wasn't really, I mean, I knew about all the great bands that I was supposed to know about growing up in Orange County, all the punk stuff I knew about. Talking Heads became my favorite band as early as, I think, 1986. So we had good music exposure. But it wasn't until, you know, the early 90s when I started hanging out with skaters and touring and traveling and going to other countries and meeting skaters.
What was the first country you went to?
Sweden, 1989.
As a skateboarder, like on a
I was still an amateur skateboarder. I went with one pro skater. We went to Sweden and we did a tour of Sweden in like shopping malls in 1989. So I would have been about 18 or 19. And then shortly thereafter, I became a pro skater.
And then you're traveling all over the place.
And then, yeah, eventually you're going to Japan and Australia and all over Europe, all over the States.
And when you're going to those places, like you mentioned, and let's jump back a little bit. When you were a kid growing up in Orange County, yeah. And Orange County is kind of famously a conservative spot of California. That's changed a little bit lately, but it's kind of been known as that kind of space. But and actually, someone may correct me on this, but I recently heard that Los Angeles now has more museums per capita than any city in America,
really?
Which it never used to. You know, they had the L.A. County Museum and some other things, but it has a ton now. Did you go to museums when you were a kid in L.A.? And if not, you know, did you go to them when you were kind of starting to travel around the world and go to places?
I did. That's the difference. That's the point of the skateboarding thing. It's ironic because Huntington Beach is only about a 40-minute drive to L.A. I didn't go to L.A. until I was about 21.
You didn't go into L.A. The city itself until you were 21
until
years
I was
old?
About 20 years old.
Wow.
Because I had moved in with Mark Gonzalez, one of the most legendary skateboarders, artists, influencers of many, 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 many skateboarders. We sort of referred to him as the Bob Dylan of skateboarding. He was the first guy that was putting jazz music in skate videos, and he was listening to everything from Freddie Fender to Hank Williams to Beethoven. He was a painter.
Yeah, Renaissance man.
Yeah, he was, and reading Dylan's autobiography recently, I mean, he's even more akin to Dylan now in my mind. But so I basically was just kind of for the most part, a normal kind of suburban kid that found skateboarding.
Just
but
kind of
before that,
in
I played baseball.
Yeah.
You know, I liked Talking Heads and I loved the Smiths and Joy Division and stuff like that. But once I became friends with Mark, that's when my world completely opened. And then my friend Chris Pastris and I, he was already big into jazz. We started Stereo Skateboards. So my mind opened up even more.
So this period of like, let's say, what, 89 to 93?
Yeah, 89 to like... 94.
This is like the big bang.
This is everything except photography.
Yeah. So as a young man, kind of growing into all that, this road trip that we've started talking about took place around, what, 2005, 2006?
2006, yep.
There's a pretty big gap in between there, which included a lot of things like moving into acting and all these other things. But were there any moments in there where you can look back now and see that seeds were kind of planted, where you started getting more interested in the concept of taking pictures? And you said, you know, taking film, doing Super 8 films and things like that. But when did that start to transition into something a little bit more purposeful?
You know? I mean, basically the gap was acting.
Yeah.
I retired from skateboarding in 95 because I felt like I was just too old for it. Because in the 90s, 25 was much older than it is today. So, I felt like I was just kind of done with it. Stereo skateboards continued. And I literally just had nothing to do with skateboarding anymore. So between 95 and 2002, I was just doing acting work.
Now, let's jump on that real quick. 25, you retire from skateboarding.
Yeah.
You know, Tony Hawk's like 93 now, right? So so he's still going. But the times were different. But did you get a lot of blowback then? People saying, what are you doing?
Yeah,
why are you
some
doing
people
this?
Were bummed that I quit when I quit.
You know.
But I genuinely, I mean, again, like, 25 today is, you're just such a kid still. Yeah. It was in skateboarding, 25 at the time. But then the people that hung on, then there's a sort of second wind, so to speak. And now you can be 53 years old. But it's different now. Everybody's skating more for fun now, it feels like. And there's just such a variety of types of skateboarding now and skateboarders. And it seems like skateboarders are much more open now to the differences in skateboarders. And
When I was doing it,
there were more sort of cliques.
Did it seem more like a sport, more competitive at that time?
It was creative. Now it's more of a sport.
Okay.
Now you've got guys that are under contract. They have to wear their Monster Energy hats.
You got out of it like right when the X Games
were kind of starting. Yeah. And I mean, what we were doing with Stereo was definitely left of center, but a lot of people were. I mean, it was much looser back then. But the age thing sort of caught me a little bit. And I just kind of felt like I'm just not having as much fun. I don't want to milk it. I don't want to disrespect skateboarding and just kind of hang on. And now in retrospect, I realized I could have hung on. And then I got Mallrats. Kevin Smith gave me that part, and that was my first movie audition. And then I just tried to pursue acting and just kind of tried to make that the next thing.
So then you have about a decade there between that and this road trip we started talking about. But one of the cool things there is obviously you're getting to be on sets. You're getting to meet cinematographers. You're getting to kind of see how that side of it works. And I know that films are a big influence on the way you kind of
the
view
way I
photography.
Shoot and the way I see. Yeah. I mean, it's a combination. I mean, I'll try to keep this short. In 02, I was on a movie set, and it just kind of dawned on me that there was stuff going on around me. I didn't pay attention on the Kevin Smith stuff outside of memorizing my dialogue and trying to perform and become, you know, at least somewhat of a decent actor if I could. And in 02, maybe I just was slightly more comfortable. I had done Almost Famous, and literally just one day it felt like I'd noticed the cameras for the first time. And suddenly the lights, and this light's bigger than that light, and that light has a blue gel on it, that light has an orange gel on it, and the film magazine, it's a 1,000-foot mag, and they're changing the lenses. And then just suddenly my world opened up, reminded me that I used to shoot Super 8 film, and I just started picking the brains of the crew. And every day on that set, I would take notes. 18% gray, okay, the gray scale, the gray. Okay, they're shooting charts because they're trying, okay, this and the film and the lights and color temperature, 3,200 Kelvin. What's Kelvin? I'd started researching.
So you can see how this starts trickling into something. A new interest is born.
And when I get into things, I tend to sort of get into them. Skateboarding, I did it every single day. Acting, I wasn't so much like I'm going to become a method actor. That one wasn't quite the same, but I was dedicated to it. But once I had that sort of epiphany and realized that there's a lot that goes into movie making, that was it for me. Note-taking every day, picking brains of people every day. I bought a Bolex 16mm camera. I bought a Mamiya RZ67. I bought a Leica M6 rangefinder and just started shooting every single day, taking notes, experimenting with lights. When I got back to LA from that shoot, I went to Sammy's camera, I bought light kits, I bought everything I could buy, and I just started experimenting from that perspective. I didn't think so much about trying to yet be a photographer. I wasn't there yet. It was more about, I want to learn about lenses and film and the characteristics of film. And it was more about...
You kind of came into it almost as a trade rather than an art form, and then kind of worked your way back, meaning like you wanted to know all the technical elements.
Yeah, I was trying to be creative with the lighting and the portraiture. And, you know, you see the things that I think you see as sort of common entry points, like Man Ray, or, which, you know, no disrespect, is stuff that I'm not necessarily interested in now. But, you know, you kind of see, if you're coming at it from where I came at it from, you're, you know, Man Ray is kind of on your radar, or, you know, you think,
I mean,
of
like
right
Eggleston
now,
and people like this.
Not, I would see, that's the point. I didn't know about Eggleston. Okay. I didn't know about
like
Eggleston.
Robert Frank.
I didn't know about Robert Frank. I didn't know about New Topographics.
Yeah.
That exhibition and movement, if you will. I didn't know about Kristen Berry yet. I didn't know about Winogrand and Henry Wessel and Stephen Shore. I didn't know about that stuff. It was more like I knew about Ansel Adams and Stieglitz,
like these,
and Steichen and Man Ray.
Like
and
Annie Leibovitz.
The experimental and the portraiture. And
sure.
So I kind of initially came at it wanting to learn about lighting. And so in photography terms, that would be the closest thing to learning about photography, is getting models and doing portraiture and doing experimenting with lighting and all of these things. And after that first road trip, I sold all of my gear.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Meetings, the lifeblood of our industry, the special sauce in our club sandwich of culture. We have long meetings and short meetings, meetings in fluorescent lit rooms, and meetings al fresco. Sometimes we even have meetings about meetings. Are we meeting too often? Do we need to meet more? Can we pencil in some time to meet about this question? Can we meet to discuss? Museums without meetings? Don't even think about it. Where else could you catch up on all those emails and texts while pretending not to do so? For more information about meetings, let's set aside a few minutes and chat.
Well, the one thing that's interesting is you can buy all this stuff, and you could, let's say you had a kid who you wanted to say, you're going to be a photographer. You buy them all the equipment, and you show them it, and you give them all the manuals of how to use it. But the one thing you can't teach is how to see something.
That's right.
You know, how to see, right? And so I guess
I was seeing stuff that I didn't, that I would later realize that I didn't want to see, but for whatever it's worth, I guess at that time maybe needed to see, because at the very least I understood more about lenses and film, and, but it's so not applicable to the lighting that I'm after when I'm out on the road and I'm shooting with natural lighting. None of the studio lighting that I experimented with applies to anything that I'm looking at now. So I don't know if it's directly related in any way, but just in terms of the time spent playing with, experimenting, at the very, very least, aside from the technical things that it taught me, it kept me excited about photography enough to where it opened up my brain to wanting to take this big Polaroid film outside and hit the road. And then when I hit the road, I was even more open to the sort of weirdnesses and, you know, the strange American landscape, all the left behind crap and just the back roads and just this kind of odd world that's out there. Once I started exposing and peeling apart those 8x10 Polaroids and seeing the results, I knew that I only wanted to be on the road and seeing what's out there more than anything. So I eventually abandoned like the backdrops and the studio lights and all that kind of stuff. And I've been on the road ever since.
In 2018, you spent weeks in Oklahoma, many weeks in Oklahoma on several different trips coming up here. The original idea was to shoot in Tulsa, but that kind of soon blossomed out and you decided to take on the whole state. When you think about that now, a year ago, what was kind of the two or three moments where you kind of felt it the most, where things clicked and you just thought, this is everything I wanted it to be? A couple of moments where maybe you're out with your son in the middle of a field walking around somewhere. It just kind of felt like what you were imagining it would be.
Well, really quickly, going back to that first road trip, the absolute elation of seeing those large format Polaroids and just the experience and the way my eyes started seeing things, you know, that's been my approach ever since. So Oklahoma has become, all these years later, an extension, a new chapter of that very first road trip back in 2006. That's one of the things that keeps me really inspired. Every road trip I've taken since then, it feels like, almost like I'm shooting a long film in a way. Like that was the first, that California was those first scenes. I've been to New Mexico, Colorado, Northern California, the Pacific Northwest, Texas.
This is like the Oklahoma season of your ongoing TV show.
Yeah, like it's the Oklahoma season. It's the Oklahoma chapter of the book, so to speak. It's the next extension of this still exciting roaming where there's just breaks in between.
And do you get as excited now when you find a great thing as you did
100%,
from day
100%.
Like, describe the moment when you're driving down the road and you see something that you're like, whoa, because the light is perfect and the thing looks great. Does that just kind of fill you with an elation that nothing else can do?
Like skateboarding, like traveling, skating and finding a spot to skate, and everybody jumps out of the van and everybody's excited, and you know, it's a very similar feeling. But to answer your question, I knew that it was the right thing to do when my first road trip, after having only been in Tulsa, right when I crossed the border on 377 from Texas going into Oklahoma, literally just right over the border, I made my first exposure. So I knew right then and there that it was the right thing to do to get out of Tulsa and really just roam, because that's what I'd been doing since 2006. And so I knew it was the right thing to do.
Because the journey, in some ways, I mean, there are almost 200 photographs in this exhibition. This is a big show on a scale that's unlike anything you've done before. So it's been a big ongoing project. The director of our museum, Scott Stoolen, is the curator of the show, and you have worked together on that in concert for the last year plus, 2 years. But when you are out there on the road, there's a narrative that's born, and there are stories here. Every photo kind of has its own element, its own little narrative, but there's kind of a connective tissue of this story, and that's what connects your photos from Texas, your photos from California, your photos in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. It's this ongoing journey, and that's what you're kind of aiming for.
Yeah, and that basically speaks to my approach as a photographer, and it also speaks to the fact that America is essentially a blanket landscape. It's more interesting to me to perhaps remind people that Oklahoma looks like Iowa, looks like California, looks like Arkansas, to varying degrees, of course, right? Versus trying to say, here's what Oklahoma looks like. Here's what Arkansas looks like. Look at the differences. I'm more interested in the similarities, because it speaks more to the American social landscape, America's history. There are many scenes that you could find anywhere that remind us of William Christen Barry's Alabama photos from 40 years ago. You know what I mean?
There's like there's a timeless.
And before that, there's Walker Evans, and look at what At Jay was doing in Paris. Do you know what I mean? Like,
there's a couple of photos in this show. One specifically that's of this very stark black and white photo of this kind of shack or rundown house sent right in the center of the frame. It's a very, very large piece. I can't remember exactly how large, but it's quite
40
big.
By 50 inches.
Yes, it's very big. And one of the cool things about this show, it's split into there's color photography, there's black and white photography. And it's impossible not to think about Oklahoma's role in the Great Depression and those amazing photographers like Evans, Lang, all these people that came through here and shot those iconic photos. And also the California connection to that stuff, too. There's this interesting kind of story there. And the road tripping element of people that left Oklahoma and drove to California. And there's just, it feels like this continuum of this idea, this kind of restless American spirit where we're kind of always looking for something. And also finding hope in moments that kind of look a little dire, you know?
I mean, I'm certainly not trying to say, oh, look at how, you know, I think it's, it's either beautiful to me or interesting or both.
Ideally and, both, yeah.
And there's certainly irony everywhere. You know, there's a small color print with a faded blue van in a driveway, and it just reads church on the side. And just those little kind of funny things to me. It's the name of the church has been painted over how many times, but the word church is still there. You know, these little things that you find that are just kind of funny. You know, you can't help but be drawn to these kind of ironies and there's has to be humor.
I'm thinking
there.
Of this giant pink flamingo floaty.
I mean,
floaty.
That's one of my favorite prints. I mean, it's just, it's and just, I've paired it with a small print of a blue inflatable pool in front of somebody's
it's
house.
It's cute. It's absurd. It's fun.
There's all of that. There has to be that. I mean, you know, like on one hand, I'm very kind of moved by Paris, Texas. But on the other hand, I wouldn't.
This is the great film by Wim Wenders.
Wenders film. But at the same time, I wouldn't be me and rounded if I weren't also an equally big fan of David Byrne's True Stories.
Yeah. So kind
which
of
are two Texas stories.
Eccentric, odd. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you're certainly net drawn to these ironic kind of odd, funny things. But, you know, overall, I think you're interested in sort of what remains and the things that kind of poke out and the contradictions and the contrasts, and which I found a lot in Oklahoma City and in Tulsa, you know, just the stark kind of differences between sort of, you know, the looming towers versus sort of what exists on the outskirts. And those are true views of a place. You know, it's not meant to point out, it's not meant to depress anyone, but it is certainly meant to show that, you know, progress is always going to leave something in its wake.
Yeah, I mean, it's
not... what's in its wake is and should be a part of the overall view, because progress doesn't always win. And I think that goes back very, very far in photography. And we certainly saw a lot of that with the new topographics photographs of, you know, just...
This is something people need to Wikipedia.
Basically, you know, when people started presenting, you know, Robert Adams started presenting, you know, the development of Colorado and... Yeah. You see, you know, these housing developments coming up.
Kind of finding the beauty in the mundane.
Yeah, and also just the reality of, you know, that view is no longer that view.
Yeah, man's impact on the American
landscape.
Yeah, that
view is no longer that view. And Robert Adams, he wrote a great book called Why People Photograph. And he writes about basically now, I mean, there's just this, what I take from it is that even if it's not seen in a photograph, because the world is so busy now, you can hear the noise and feel the pollution outside of the frame of the image. Everything is so noisy and polluted and occupied, and there aren't many unpolluted views anymore. I want to show, I mean, I think it's in some way important to kind of show that, just the truth of the way things lie.
I know a lot of writers and several artists, for example, who are fairly accomplished people, and I know that they still feel uncomfortable at a party when someone says, "What do you do?" And they say, "I'm a writer." You know, it's hard for them to say. But we know. I wonder now. You know, you have kind of so many different things. If someone says, "What do? You say, "I'm a photographer." Is that kind of your identity now? Meaning, like, that's you. You view that as your vocation first and foremost.
I mean,
it's more than a hobby. Way more than a hobby.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I don't want to be like, I'm a skateboarder, an actor.
Right.
You know, I usually just say photographer.
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes I'll be like, are you an actor too? Yeah, you know.
Well, if someone doesn't know you, meaning, you know, they walk up to you.
I mean, I think because there's just so much photography in my brain right now, at the very least, I usually say photographer.
I mean, if they talk to you for 5 minutes, they're going to get that you're into photography. You talk about it a lot, and you're very passionate about it. So.
Yeah.
What's next? You know, Oklahoma is in the can. It's on the walls.
Well, I've got to do the book.
There's a book coming.
The book, the Oklahoma book, is going to take a long time.
Books, plural, right? Are we doing a two-volume?
We're going to see. I'd love to do a two-volume slipcase, but, things change. I mean, the layout of this exhibition changed God knows how many
times. So
that's
a big project on the horizon.
Yeah, the book. And then next year, Stanley Barker, the publisher in the UK, they've done some really beautiful photo books. They reached out and expressed interest in doing a book of some of my black and white photos from the archives. This is basically probably 2008 onward, covering California, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, and Texas with mostly 35 millimeter film. Because I put to bed the Polaroid thing after those first couple of road trips and started using the smaller cameras. I think in 2021, we're going to do a second printing of a plain view.
This is your book of Texas photographs.
So a few books over the next few years and maybe try to do some acting work. I sometimes kind of miss that. It's really fun being on set and getting to use that other side of my brain. And the skateboarding stuff will continue, thank God. That's such a big part of my life. And I'd like to start maybe directing some films. That's one of my, I think more than anything, I draw from film and cinematography, and I take a lot of that with me on these road trips. And, you know, those influences certainly help guide what I see, you know, when I'm out on the road. And
well, one thing people can do as we wrap up here is people can come. We're going to be doing this really cool thing where we are taking over this giant drive-in movie theater, the Admiral Twin Drive-In here in Tulsa, which was in the film The Outsiders. It's this kind of iconic mid-century space, this giant, huge screen. You're going to show some of your photos on the screen. We're going to talk about the thing. And then we're going to show Rumblefish, which is this amazingly photographed Francis Ford Coppola film shot in Tulsa with this great soundtrack by Stuart Copeland from The Police. Mm-hmm. And we'll kind of talk about the influence of film on your photographs and some other things. So that's coming up in August so people can get tickets for that and all that. And thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Numismatics is the study or collection of currency, coins, tokens, paper money, and other related objects. The American Numismatic Association, located in Colorado Springs, was founded in 1891 by Dr. George F. Heath. It's also home to the Money Museum. In the spring of 2012, a 33-year-old man named Wyatt Yeager was sentenced to 27 months in federal prison for the theft of approximately 300 historically significant coins and objects from the Money Museum. Yeager was the collections manager. In restitution for his crimes, he was ordered to pay back $948,000. The stolen coins and objects were sold at various auctions at home and abroad. Many have been recovered, most have not. For a full comprehensive list of what's been found and what's still at large, visit money.org and look for the tab titled Museum Theft. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.